Since the beginning of the year, 10 Palestinian miners were killed in the occupied West Bank by Israeli forces using live ammunition. Palestinians accuse Israel of using unjustified force against their children. They even warn that Israeli soldiers will continue killing children in cold blood as long as they won't face inquiry. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Speaker of Iran's parliament, Mohammad Baqir Qalibov, has met Syria's President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. Assad said that Iran is a main partner for Syria, which offered its support in all sectors. He asserted that ongoing coordination for fighting terror had a positive impact on the ground and will continue until the liberation of all Syrian territories. Qalibov said the Syrian and Iranian people's determination to participate in the recent presidential elections in the two countries proves the failure of policies of pressure adopted by their enemies. Qalibov held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart, Hammoudeh Sabbagh. He said military and political relations with Syria are currently in their strongest and best form, expressing willingness to enhance economic cooperation with Syria.
After their failure in military war against Iran, the Zionist and U.S. regimes have waged an economic war against us. Our joint priority now is to achieve development in our countries, improve our economy, restore the infrastructure, and increase the bulk of mutual trade exchange.
Sabbagh referred to the high level of coordination between parliaments of Iran and Syria, affirming that the two countries stand together in the resistance alliance, working to eliminate hegemony and colonialism which their enemies are imposing on the region.
We held a very special and important meeting for further coordination between both parliaments through consultations and the exchange of expertise. We also agreed on activating the work of our friendship committees in the two parliaments for the benefit of the two peoples.
Speaker Qalibov also held talks with Syria's Prime Minister Hussein Arnous. They underlined the importance of expansion of economic cooperation in both public and private sectors for facing economic sanctions, as well as the siege imposed on the Iranian and Syrian people. The exchange of visits between Iranian and Syrian officials reflects the strong historic ties between the two countries. There has been a noticeable development in economic, political, military, and parliamentary cooperation since the start of the war on Syria, which represents an alliance both states are strengthening to counter U.S. and Western pressure against them. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki and his wife.
Addressing the press, a member of Zazaki's defense team said the Kaduna State High Court discharged and acquitted Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat of all 8 charges in a ruling that lasted for several hours. The judge ruled that the prosecution has failed to establish any case against the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria and his wife.
The court ruled that the charge ought not to be in the first place. You cannot arraign a man for an offense that was allegedly committed, as at the time the said crime was not an offense. And the court was very emphatic in that. That yes, the Kaduna State government has powers to enact laws, but they cannot enact laws to prosecute an offense retrospectively.
Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat were arrested in December 2015 following an attack on his home and worship center by soldiers of the Nigerian army, which resulted in the killing of hundreds of Zazaki's supporters. In a statement, the Islamic movement said the judgment is a vindication of Sheikh Zazaki and a victory for truth and justice against tyranny and oppression.
The events of December 12th and 15th of 2015 were orchestrated by state machineries who are using the instrumentalities of state apparatus to fight a religious fight. It is strictly the events of December 12, 2015 is strictly a fight between Shiites and Sunnis, fights that was imported from Saudi Arabia for whatever purpose.
The Kaduna State High Court has set Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat free. The Islamic movement and indeed many of Zazaki's supporters have expressed happiness with the outcome of this judgment. Benjamin Abdullahi, Kaduna.
Okay. 3,000 of Ethiopian refugees crossed the Sudanese borders on Monday, arriving at Taya village at Plasunda locality in Gadarif state. Reports say the refugees is considered the biggest number of refugees to cross into the country in only one day since the outbreak of war last November in Tigray region. Many believe that the wave may worsen security and humanitarian situation in the region due to armed conflicts erupting at western area of Ethiopia.
Sudan has adopted an open-door policy in receiving Ethiopian refugees since the beginning of the conflict. So far, Sudan has welcomed about 75,000 to 80,000 refugees. We call on the international community to help us meet the needs of the increasing refugees fleeing from the fight in the Tigray region.
Since the beginning of fighting, tens of thousands of Ethiopians have sought safety in Sudan, but conditions in Sudan refugee camps are presenting new challenges, as Sudanese NGOs early responded to humanitarian situation in states affected of refugees influx.
Actually, since the crisis of the refugees started, the Tigray crisis started, Sudanese Red Crescent has been present from day one. And that is basically because we do have our ongoing activities in the region through our branches in Kassala and Gadarif. So we do have ongoing programs for the already existed old refugees in the area. So with the beginning of the crisis, we were already on the ground.
In the light of the latest development in the Tigray region, UN agencies strive to maintain a strong staff presence, provided there is access in Hamadayet in case there is an increased influx. Several partners continue to remain on the ground in anticipation of this possibility.
Security and health challenges face Sudanese and Ethiopian governments to cope with increasing number of refugees. Khartoum says it is still waiting for international support to tackle the crisis. Muhammad Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
An Algerian judoka athlete who made headlines last week for shunning an Israeli opponent at the Tokyo Olympics has now been temporarily suspended along with his coach from the International Judo Federation, meaning that Fethi Nurin will not be able to compete after making his bold statement in support of Palestine. After returning to Algeria, V secured an exclusive interview with Nurin to ask why he felt he had to walk.
I was pitted to play against an athlete from the usurper entity occupying Palestinian land, a regime which kills innocent people and drives them out of their homes, day and night. Because of this, I don't accept that my hand is smeared with someone who represents an entity like this, and for his flag to be associated with the Algerian flag, which is in support of the Palestinians' cause.
His actions meant he would miss out on a chance to win a medal, but Nurin admitted he had no regrets.
If the same situation arises, I would not hesitate to take the same decision. The world needs to know that Israel is an occupier and they practice all kinds of laws that deviate from the international laws and human rights. We need to send a message to the world that we deal with all religions with dignity, just as the Islamic religion recommended us to do. Except for the ones who fight against the religion and the Muslims. We are against them and it's our rights to respond to them. We have the right to defend our religion and all oppressed Muslims.
The Olympic Charter takes a strong stance against any political acts, stating that no kind of demonstration or political, religious or racial propaganda is permitted.
However, this isn't the first time that a Muslim athlete has protested against this controversial lineup. Many are now starting to ask questions about the Olympics and their lack of sensitivity on the subject. Also, are the games being used to whitewash Israel at a time when Palestinians remain deeply oppressed? Robert Carter, London.
More and more people in the EU are congregating indoors. The highly contagious Delta variant of COVID-19 is spreading like wildfire in countries like France and Spain. More people are also travelling within the EU. Citizens in Brussels have been sharing their thoughts on the Delta variant.
I don't know where the cases come from, if it's a coffee restaurant or just meeting in our house.
when I see how people are behaving sometimes, yeah, I'm not surprised.
The European Central Bank, which manages the euro, says economic confidence is being undermined.
The pandemic continues to cast a shadow, especially as the Delta variant constitutes a growing source of uncertainty.
On Monday, EU finance ministers rubber-stamped COVID-19 recovery funding for four additional nations in the 27-country bloc.
Croatia, Cyprus, Lithuania and Slovenia. Now more than a half of national plans is adopted.
However, critics say the billions of euro being administered to national governments will result in citizens being saddled with decades more austerity because there is too much emphasis on loans rather than grants. According to analysts, EU leaders are harming the bloc's economy through their foreign policy. Sanctions are inhibiting trade. Economists say the Iranian market represents a big opportunity. It can be availed of if current efforts to save the JCPOA-Iran nuclear deal succeed. We have been speaking to the head of the European Parliament's Iran delegation about the subject via Skype. She believes the agreement will be reinstated soon.
Many people in Iran say, oh, again and again and again, we have not a good partner on this side. This is one of the impacts of this horrible, stupid policy of Trump.
The International Labour Organization, ILO, warns an additional 25 million jobs could be lost globally before the end of this year due to the coronavirus. However, the ILO says if we see an internationally coordinated policy response, the number of people losing their jobs could be much lower. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Lebanese Prime Minister-designate Najib Mikati said he hoped he can regain the trust of the people and the role of the state. He also vowed to meet with President Michel Aoun regularly in order to speed up the formation of the new government.
There was full unanimity on demand and swiftness in the formation of the new government. And after today's session, I briefed President Aoun on the outcome, and I always visit the presidential palace in order to achieve the government's formation as soon as possible.
Mikati spoke after a day of non-binding meetings with Lebanese lawmakers who stated their views after separate consultations. Free Patriotic Movement declared it will not be taking part in the next government, but will offer all the necessary facilitations and support for a quick formation.
We're starting from scratch. We're starting something new, no baggage. No one is carrying any historical disagreements between the parties. That's what we heard from the designated prime minister, and we hope that that will be reflected in the coming future, within hours or days at least, that this will make a difference.
Prime Minister Designate stressed that he has the foreign support necessary to begin economic reforms. One member of parliament told Press TV that when they asked about this support, Mikati stressed that France has given him assurances that after the formation of the cabinet, they will give all assistance to resolve the financial and economic crisis. However, this assistance will not be without interest.
No foreign country would give assistance for free. It has its own interests in mind as well. It's only natural when France gives aid to Lebanon, it has ambitions. If France assists in rebuilding the port, it could be the main future authority in the port of Beirut and could be managing the trade and commerce from Europe to the entire Arab world. If it rebuilds the electricity sector, it will also be a good investment for French companies. And at the same time, Lebanon is in drastic need of that assistance.
The main concern for all sides is salvaging the country's economy, which has been described by the World Bank as one of the world's worst since the 1850s. After initial meetings with lawmakers, the real political bargaining begins for the formation of the government. This in itself could prove to be controversial, with Mikati stressing the need for keeping to the French initiative, opponents stressing the need for adhering to the National Charter of Confessional Representation. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
The British government has decided to expand blanket stop-and-search powers under a new plan to beat crime. Measures unveiled on Tuesday include changes to police powers to allow searching people without suspicion in areas where they believe violence could break out under the Section 60 Criminal Justice and Public Order Act.
Across all stop and searches powers, black people are 9 times more likely to be stopped than white people. But under the Section 60 Act, that rate is even higher at a whopping 18 times. Moreover, the research data shows that in 99% of Section 60 searches, no weapon is found.
Press TV got a reaction to this story from Charles Critchlow, former president of the National Black Police Association. He said,
"This government has abandoned any pretense of a desire for a fair and just society, particularly insofar as black people are concerned. First of all, the efficacy of such an approach is not proven. Moreover, it's counterproductive in that it alienates the community when the support of the community is critical."
His thoughts were echoed by Suleiman Lee, a community activist from Black Child Promotions, who himself has been harassed by the police.
There's always going to be conflict at street level. There's disorganized crime, then there's organized crime. And as I said before, black youth cannot facilitate any criminal underworld. They can only participate. A lot of black youth, they're serving time, even though we're 3% of the population, according to the 2011 census, we're disproportionately represented in the prisons at Her Majesty's pleasure.
The government announcement came 2 months after the Criminal Justice Alliance, a network of 160 organisations, called for the power to be repealed, arguing that Section 60 had led to thousands of innocent people being unnecessarily stopped and searched every year, with the number of searches rising from 622 in 2016 to 2017 to more than 18,000 in 2019 to 2020. It seems unlikely that Priti Patel will bow to pressure from campaigners, after already dismissing the criticisms levied against the plans, much like she dismissed the sentiments behind the Black Lives Matter protests that swept throughout the UK. Ahmed Cabello, London.
Hi, good morning. Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, sir.
Hi, kiddie. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello. Good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing him. Terence fall low in awe of him. Faces are humbled in fear of him, and everything mighty yields to his mightiness. So to thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may his blessings be upon his messenger endlessly, and his salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then fail to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio. the Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. An Israeli-owned ship was attacked off of Oman. Sources close to the resistance say that the attack was in response to Israeli attacks in Syria, especially the one on an airport in Syria's western Qusair region, where two resistance fighters were killed. Now, Tel Aviv is pointing the finger at Iran for the raid, where two crew members were killed. So far, Tehran has not commented on the attack. Stay with us as we take a look at the story on the Spotlight. Well, I'd like to start it all off crossing over to Damascus and talking to Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali, thanks so much for being with us. Well, fill us in on what you know about this situation.
Yes, what we know is that there was an Israeli-owned ship attacked about 280 kilometers northeast of the coast of Oman. Of course, we have a resistance source that told the media that the attack was in response to the Israeli attack that happened about 10 days ago on Al-Qusair area, which is an area on the borderline between Syria and Lebanon, of course, on the Syrian side. Of course, Syria did not comment on the issue. However, Syria sent tens of letters to the United Nations Security Council calling on the international body on every, of course, Israeli attack to shoulder its responsibility in preserving international peace and security and taking measures against Israel in order to stop it from carrying out such attacks. Now, it really seems that the resistance source, by, of course, giving such information, is saying that resistance forces in this region will not allow Israel anymore to attack resistance forces, to attack sovereign countries, and there will be a price for every attack. This is the first message that the resistance in the region wants to send to Israel. The second is a message to the international community. Of course, as I told you, Syria sent letters to the United Nations, called on the international community to do something. Nothing was done in the past 10 years. Israel continues to occupy Syria and attack it. And this is the second message, that if the international community is not going to do anything about such illegal attacks, the resistance will do.
All right, thanks so much for that update out of Damascus. That's Muhammad Ali. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, political commentator Mohammed Obaid out of Beirut, and journalist and political commentator Sayed Mohsen Abbas out of London. Thank you both for being with us. Let's start this off in Beirut. And Mohammed, well, a source close to the resistance says this attack was a retaliation for Israeli aggression in Syria. Your take on the possibility of that and the importance of it, if it's true?
Well, first of all, you have to take into account that this method is being used in correspondence with what the Israelis have been doing. They have always been launching aggressions against Syria, against other areas, and letting the Arab press media report that it was Israel without the Israelis adopting this. But sometimes the Israeli officials could not take it anymore, and they used to brag about these aggressions and say that it was up to them to prevent the what they call the axis of evil, which we call the axis of resistance, in order to claim a responsibility for these attacks. So what the resistance source has really done recently is that they have adopted the policy of this ambiguity, sort of, because you don't have an official claim of responsibility by the Islamic Republic or by any resistance group, but it is understood that this is coming as part of, or as a retaliation to the Israeli aggression against the Qusair area in Syria. So the Israelis are not really used to this, because throughout their history they have been acting with this thuggish way of behaving against other countries, against sovereign countries, and the world has always been turning the blind eye to these aggressions. So it is up to you then to defend yourself in order to sort of tit for tat. I mean, you have to make the aggressor pay a price for the aggressions that they are carrying out.
Said Moshe, your perspective, the significance of this Israeli ship being hit.
Well, the significance is that we no longer have a one-way traffic in terms of the Israelis routinely trying to roll out their Yinon plan by attacking their neighbors. We no longer have a free run for the Israelis to balkanize the Middle East. They no longer have the fear factor which they cultivated over many decades to cow all opposition into submission. Of course, with some backup, it was the American military backup which previously kept them floating. They actually are capable of making their own arms and are increasingly self-sufficient in that respect, but they still get over $3.8 billion worth of aid on paper. It's probably a lot more privately through all the American Zionist donors. So we know that Israel has used this kind of backup of American imperialism to create chaos and to create terror in that region. Syria has been, of course, it's one of its major targets from a very long time. Basically, Syria did back the Palestinian movement in the region. They did back the Lebanese resistance. They were always, even under Hafez al-Assad, stoically opposed to Israeli imperialism and its the practices that they were carrying out in the region. And of course, as time's gone on, what we've seen is the Israelis have been part and parcel of the creation of the civil war in Syria, first of all, then the launch of ISIS in Syria and Iraq and beyond. Israel is very much behind that. They not only are behind it, but they've also been servicing, training, and medically supporting the ISIS proxy forces in that region. So you can see there are multiple layers of Israeli provocation and, aggression against certainly Syria, certainly against Lebanon, certainly against all nations that want sovereignty and independence intact. In response, what we've seen is the confidence of the resistance growing. It started with Hezbollah managing to defeat, essentially, Israel's invasion of Lebanon, not once, but twice. And since then, it's the resistance that has been arguably on the front foot. Israel now relies on aerial power, terror from the air. But even that is becoming even more suspect because we've seen Israeli missiles being intercepted, destroyed by Syrian air defense. Some argue it's the Russians who are doing that. Either way, it is Syria on paper which is rebutting Israel's attack. So it's actually reducing Israel's credibility as an undisputed power in that region.
Well, Mohammed, what about that? I mean, we've been seeing Israel illegally bombing Syria for years now. And now with the situation, with the bombing of this Israeli ship, we're seeing outrage being expressed by these Western countries. And mum is the word, more or less, when Israel continues to violate Syrian territory. Do you think this hypocrisy by these Western countries have revealed themselves more and more as far as their real intentions in dealing with this region, especially when it comes to Israel?
Well, we have to keep into account, we have to keep in our minds that if it weren't for the political and military and the financial aid provided by the Western countries, Israel would not even survive for one day in the region within this hostile atmosphere and environment that is everybody in the region regards Israel as an illegitimate entity that was based and erected on the usurpery of the land of the Palestinians. So if it weren't for this political support of this turning the blind eye by the West to the Israeli aggressions and all the massacres that have been going on throughout our region for over 70 years now, Israel would not have been able to keep going with that. But this turns the other side, the side that is taking the blows, I mean, the other countries, the countries that have been receiving the aggressions of the Israeli entity, Turn more bold, because you cannot remain on the side of the being killed while remaining silent. So you have to manage, you have to develop your own methods of defending yourself, defending your country, defending the sovereignty of your country. So this is a rational and logical development of events in the region. If you have any other country in the world just remaining them, putting them, their back to the wall, I mean, receiving attacks all the time by an aggressive force, it is natural and more than natural to just retaliate in order to stop the aggression against you.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mohsen, what about that? Do you think that the narrative has basically changed and we've gone from a time where Israel would basically deal with hit and run, but now we're more likely to see a tit for tat, and Tel Aviv realizes and understands that the transition has taken place?
Absolutely, it does, and their military generals have acknowledged this. I think in practical terms, you can see from their tactics, every time that there is a head-on collision with any of the resistance, and I'm including the Palestinian resistance most recently, if we include the Lebanese resistance, or even if we talk about, you know, the Syrian resistance, the fact of the matter is that Israel no longer rattles its saber in the way that it used to. What it does now, it does this kind of lower form of, if you like, tit for tat, as you put it, quite succinctly. That's just designed to really make everybody think that they've still got, the nerve to face up to the resistance axis. But increasingly, what we're seeing is that they are not even able to outright launch land invasions, for instance. They didn't do it again with Gaza, you know, that open-air prison camp which they maintained. They couldn't really do exactly what they wanted after so many Palestinian resistance missiles violated their so-called Iron Dome. So again, the Iron Dome has been shattered as an impregnable defense mechanism, and that's been done by the resistance axis's own tactics, which penetrated the Israeli defense. We know that in Lebanon, the much-wanted Israeli military, with its state-of-the-art tanks, etc., was taken out by very simple Lebanese Hezbollah forces tactics, using particular anti-tank missiles in a certain way where they could hit these tanks from both angles, shocking the Israeli forces and actually forcing their retreat inflicting a major damage to the morale of the army, which I don't think they recovered. It's admitted even by the Israeli generals themselves that they don't have that scale of morale. What's happening now is really a fundamental sea change. You have an Israeli defense force of basically young people that they conscript, they're forced to serve in the army, essentially. They've got, the resistance axis, which because of the Israeli and the Zio-American shenanigans in the Middle East, have been now trained with wars in Syria, with wars in Iraq, with wars across that region, which have been instigated by these Zio-imperialists. Trained up. They basically made those forces battle-hardened. And what the Israeli Defense Force is scared of is that their own individual conscripts, who never faced a real war, haven't fought real soldiers or a real army, for that matter, are not really up to the job. They're therefore relying on aircraft attacks or internet warfare or these little tactical hijacking attacks of ships around the world. That's what they're reduced to.
Well, Mohammed, now Iran has said that it holds Israel responsible for terrorist attacks against it, and that Tehran will protect this region against aggression. I mean, what exactly does that mean? Do you think that it means that anywhere in the region where Tel Aviv crosses Tehran's red lines could mean trouble for the Zionist regime?
Yes, absolutely. But if you follow up the Israeli media today, you'd just be astonished at how much they have been confused, how much they have been contradicting each other. You have reports that are blaming Israel for itself for playing with fire in the first place. you have politicians, Israeli politicians, claiming that they will need to retaliate for that attack, and then you have others quoting officials that they will report the case to the UN and they will have the case there. So a sort of confusion, as I said in the first section of my what I said, the Israelis are not used to this. They have been used to be the thug of the area and then launch aggressions against all the peoples of the region and then returning home safely with their warplanes and so, and then receiving a pat on the shoulder by the Americans and the other Western forces, and this country or that European country is offering them official and, financial and economic aid this way or another. You have, for example, you see fruits and the produce of the settlements, the occupied settlements that the whole world believes are occupied and UN believes are occupied Palestinian territories. You have them offered the special and favorite way of treatment by the European countries. So you see, the whole thing is a new phase for the mm-hmm. Israelis, always been used to just launch aggressions and go unpunished.
What about that transition, said Mohsen? I mean, overall, what does this attack say about the strength of the resistance and the change, as Mohammed was just talking about, that the regime in Tel Aviv is not used to this type of response?
Well, you can clearly see the progression from very confident Israeli war stances during the Yom Kippur War and, you know, even in the time of the conquest of the Golan Heights. And you can see the difference in the postures of the Israelis. And that's primarily one of a much more cautious, much more defensive, much more nervous nature on the Israelis' part. That's purely and simply because they recognize and they understand, their intelligence services, their military intelligence understands the military capabilities which the resistance axis now has. Of course, the raids in Syria are primarily a sort of a knee-jerk, nervous reaction to the fact that the Islamic Republic of Iran has free brotherly access to Syrian territory in order to defend Syria's sovereignty, which has been violated again by ISIS and the sort of forces that the Zio Western imperialists have been imposing on Syria. But that nervousness obviously manifests with these kind of constant aerial raids. That's the only area in which the Israelis now feel that they have a clear superiority. Of course, the other area that we need to consider is the ballistic missile capability. And Israel will argue that, well, we're going in to destroy the capability of Iran, particularly in Syria, or the Syrians themselves, of being able to launch ballistic missile attacks from those territories. This is, quite frankly, nonsense. What they're really doing is they're just trying to keep up appearances for their own citizens. Look, when the Israelis bomb or try to attack Syrian sites, there's no confirmation of the actual locations that they're hitting actually being of any real significance. You know, casualties are reported, all too often civilian casualties. Israel itself doesn't provide any evidence that they've been able to take out so-called military or Iranian military bases, or Syrian ones for that matter. What's really going on is quite often they're just going through an exercise of trying to look like they're still in the game. The Russians have an interesting role to play in this. They could give S-400s to the Syrian air defense or the resistance. They certainly say they've given S-300s, and we know that Israeli missiles have been intercepted. So clearly there is a deterrence power that the resistance has. Iran itself has highly sophisticated ballistic missiles, which they demonstrated with their destruction of Ain al-Assad base in Iraq, when the Americans, went for their own mad scheme of killing and martyring Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. So, mm-hmm. What we've got is a situation now where the old
Israeli-American imperialism is desperately trying to keep its own citizens, its own people on board to say, look, we still have the capability to defend you. They're losing that battle, because and what we've got is the resistance axis proving day on day that they are getting ever closer to really shutting down the illegitimate Israel occupation.
Okay, stay with him, said Moshe. What about that, Mohammed? Do you think that Tel Aviv is more vulnerable today than it ever has been in its existence?
Yes, of course. But the more important is the impact of this whole thing. I mean, strategically speaking, that the role of Israel, and this, by the way, a statement was made by current President Joe Biden, explaining why he supports Israel. He says that Israel is cheaper than any warplane carrier or whatever that we would put here in order to put our troops. So this tells you about the function that the West sees in Israel. Israel that used to launch aggressions, as we've been saying since the beginning of the show, throughout its history, 70 years ago, is now unable to launch an aggression on Gaza without expecting a retaliation. So this is means a major change and a shift in the function of Israel. Israel is no longer the barricade or the barracks of the West.
Okay.
They are not in order to take a certain product from that entity.
I'm so sorry to interrupt you. I'd love to continue talking about this, but we're out of time. I appreciate both of you being with us. Political commentator Mohammed Obaid out of Beirut, journalist and political commentator Syed Mohsen Abbas out of London. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
The term post-traumatic stress disorder is widely used to describe the psychological effects of war or disaster. Yet the term may not be applicable to Palestinians who have been attacked repeatedly and oppressed without pause for many decades. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Esra Saleh Al-Nemi, reporter. This article is published under the heading, Trauma is Constant for Gaza's Children. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Ahmad is aged at that age children can feel increasingly confident. Their creativity can blossom. They can become more aware of what is happening in the world. Over the past 8 years, Ahmad has been exposed to a world of both horror and joy. He has already lived through two large-scale Zionist regime attacks on Gaza, one in summer of 2014, the other in May this year. On May 15th, the Zionist regime bombed the Abu Khattab family's home in Bish refugee camp without warning. Of the 10 people martyred in that incident, 2 were mothers and 8 were children. Ahmad was a neighbor and friend to some of those children. He cannot understand why they were wiped out so violently. "We used to play together in the yard," he said. "We played football and hide and seek. Why will we never see them again?" Both during and after the May attack, Ahmad has encountered trouble sleeping at night. When he gets to sleep, he often has nightmares. The term post-traumatic stress disorder is widely used to describe the psychological effects of war or disaster. Yet the term may not be applicable to Palestinians who have been attacked repeatedly and oppressed without pause for many decades. Dr. Yasser Abu Jam'i from the Gaza Community Mental Health Program points out that each Israeli regime attack triggers painful memories of previous attacks. Healing thereby becomes more difficult. Gazans are not in a post-traumatic condition, but in an ongoing condition that needs deeper attention, he wrote during the May offensive. In 2020, the Gaza Community Mental Health Program assisted more than 3,200 children, according to Abu Jam'i. It is 2 months since the Israeli regime's latest attack ended, he told the electronic Intifada. We don't yet have the final figures for how many children we are assisting because of that attack, but I can tell you that the numbers are big, and they will be bigger than those for the last year. There has been a discernible increase, Abu Jam'i confirmed, in problems associated with childhood stress since the May offensive. Such problems include hyperactivity, disobedience toward parents, nightmares, aches in joints, and panic attacks. The Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor states that before the May attack, approximately 33% of Gaza's children required support because of trauma resulting from previous Israeli regime violence. The proportion of children who are traumatized has risen to more than 90% following the May offensive. The Zionist regime killed 66 children during the attack. 11 of those children had been receiving psychological support from refugee councils. Muhammad 11 vomited frequently in the 2 weeks after the May attack. His weight dropped considerably. The area near us was bombed very heavily, said Muhammad's father. My son was terrified. He started to deteriorate gradually. As a result of trauma care, Muhammad's health has subsequently improved. Dr. Sami Oveda from the Gaza Community Mental Health Program has counseled Muhammad. Encouraging children to express themselves is vital, Oveda noted. We notice sometimes that children avoid speaking about the traumatic experiences that they went through, he said. Our task is to urge them to speak about their experiences and to share their fears. We have to respect children's thoughts and feelings so that we can dispel their fears. Reaching out to their mothers or fathers for comfort is literally impossible for some. More than 240 children lost one or both parents during the May attack, according to Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor. Turning to teachers is not a viable option in many cases either. Schools in Gaza remain closed because of the COVID-19 pandemic. The situation makes dealing with trauma all the more difficult. Children need to spend time together, said Oveda. In school, they are with their peers. They can talk and express themselves better for that reason. The importance of having a good time cannot be exaggerated for traumatized children. Much therapy is based on enabling children to have fun. Oveda said children need to play. That is how they release the negative energy inside them.
morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.